So welcome to the Sunday night There Is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website, oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. We will now introduce our speaker, a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or to ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. Please help me to welcome Bonnie P., a compulsive overeater, and I will let her tell us more about herself. Go ahead, Bonnie. Thank you for joining us.
You're muted, Bonnie.
Oh, okay. I just said, I thank you so much for inviting me. It's a good thing I do not have to travel because I'd be coming from Boston. Hold on. I wanted to just set my timer, which I like to do. Okay. So I am Bonnie P. I'm a born again compulsive overeater. And the reason I say that is explained on page 63 of the Big Book. As we felt new power flow in and we enjoy peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and thereafter. We were reborn. So that's how I feel comfortable introducing myself. So I'm going to divide my share into two parts, which is my food background, behaviors as a kid and an adult, how my life was affected, and then part B, which is my path to recovery and how I work my program. So my disclaimer, so I don't have to keep on saying for me, for me, for me, is that whatever I say is for me. So my parents, my dad was a Holocaust survivor, which obviously presented many challenges. He came here and had a very low opinion of overweight Americans that he just called fat all the time. So my mom was a compulsive overeater and he yelled at her to lose weight and she never did. I believe I heard that he made her promise before they got married that she would lose weight, but obviously as a compulsive overeater, you know, that just wasn't something in the cards. But the message was, if you were fat, you were a failure. So even though you were successful, you were rich, the community loved you, whatever it was, you were a failure. If you were fat, all that was just nixed out by the fat. So my mom would push food on us and then my dad would, you know, pull it away. He never allowed much food in the house. I think if I can remember, our refrigerator filled with lettuce, American cheese, tuna, and cottage cheese. And that was it. But my mom would buy food and we would hide it like in between, you know, in the far end of the cabinet. And that's where I began to hide my entire life. I never ate in public. I remember one time as a kid, not to list a few, but one time that stuck out was my sister and I were having an ice cream party. Up in her, it was a 3-4 house, so she was in her loft, and it was ice cream and hot fudge and everything sprawled out. My dad called from below, Bonnie, Gail, and we threw the quilt over the ice cream, the hot fudge, and everything. We just threw the bedding over it. So that was the beginning. So my mom had diabetes, you know, really, really bad. And she was on pills and shots. And I remember one scene, which she opened her closet and all this food fell out, like all these packages of food. I don't know where she got it, but she must have bought it or a friend bought it. And I just screamed. And my father came because I couldn't understand why she wouldn't stop. She knew she was killing herself. I felt she didn't love us. I blamed her for not being able to control it. And I turned her in, which I definitely now feel bad for. She must have been totally humiliated. So in middle school, she fell and her ankle just came out of like her leg and there was blood everywhere and you could just see the bone. It just kind of split. And so I called an ambulance. She went to the hospital and she had her leg amputated. And back then prosthetics weren't really that great. My dad then locked the kitchen door. So she couldn't go in the kitchen door. And she would go down the stairs, walk around to the back, and go up the stairs. And I just remember being petrified that in her walker, she could do this. But that's how bad her disease was. So I was 25 when she died from complications of her disease. I mean, nobody actually dies from being a compulsive overeater, but they die from like the comorbidities and the stuff that happens from that. And my brother also died from that. I believe, I know I was born a compulsive overeater. My first memories in life have to do with food. I remember one episode where we were served borscht soup on a Jewish holiday. And I tasted it, and it was like a lightning bolt just went across my body. And I looked at it, and the only thing I could think of is that I wanted more. I didn't even think of enjoying it. I just thought of wanting more. And from then on, my disease, it was always about the next bite. It was never enjoying the bite I was having. So some of the things that happened at camp, I remember the other kids playing when we were served food, family style, and I could never understand how they could play and like play patty cake and stuff when I was watching the kitchen, waiting for that, you know, food to come out. And the counselors had to say, come on, guys, eat. And I just could never understand that. And another thing was that I threw my bathing suits up on the rafters very young because I didn't want to wear them. I can promise you that I was the only kid in camp, probably the only kid in the state of Massachusetts that threw their bathing suits up on the rafters so they wouldn't have to wear them. My parents had to drive, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours away to replace my bathing suits. And obviously it was clear, even though I tried to blame other kids, it was pretty clear I did it. And so fast forward to high school. I found a quack doctor, it's what they called them then. And we would wait in line for diet pills. So I think most of the kids who waited in line were not compulsive overeaters. They just wanted to diet and look like Twiggy. But I, on the other hand, would speed from here to tomorrow. And I would search those pharmacies because in the years at the end, it was such a controlled substance that they stopped selling them to pharmacies. But I would drive all over the state to find it. And that was when I started my, what I call my 3+3, which was I sped my ass off literally for 3 days and didn't eat. And then 3 days of beyond binging. I mean, just binging and put my body through like World War III. And then I couldn't even eat for the next day, 3 days, because I was in recovering from such trauma to my body. So that 3+3 lasted forever. That was my dieting. I could never diet. I just could never diet, but my 3+3 was my diet. So I had 3 pregnancies, fast forward to that, which had a huge impact on my addiction. I gained 50 pounds with each. And I remember buying, you know, 2 Chinese food luncheon specials, one I would eat there and one I would eat in my car. So that was a license to eat for 2. Trust me, I took advantage of that. So at 35, when I was stuck with the weighing 222, I became bulimic. At first, it started because I ate so much that my body just couldn't digest all the food and it just came back up. And then eventually, I couldn't stand the feeling. I couldn't stand that I wasn't losing the weight. And so I made myself throw up. And it's hard to, as you start to do that, you have to be more aggressive and more aggressive to get the food up. I apologize for being so graphic, but if it helps anybody, I'm gonna. So it would get in my hair, in my clothes, it would smell. It was incredibly degrading, but I kept it up. And at one point I would stick objects or just go further down because again, especially like bread and carbohydrates that stick to you, it's really difficult to get those back up. However, ice cream is pretty easy to get back up. My medical conditions from that I have vocal cord trauma. So I don't know if you can tell, but my voice kind of goes in and out. Because I literally just had direct trauma to the vocal cords. And also, I remember I went to the hospital once thinking I was having a heart attack and they discovered I had a hernia. I don't know for sure that that hole in my stomach was caused by the vomiting, but I have to believe at that young age, it probably had something to do with it because it would be unusual. I had read that when the acid keeps coming up, it burns a hole. Food is not meant to come up. It's just meant to go down. It's now in my medical record. My husband has long-term health insurance, but I don't. So I will end up in the state somewhere because they just will not, if you have any kind of psychological issues. I wasn't able to get it. So I stole and I lied my whole life. I would eat at grocery stores and leave the empty wrappers and packages in the store. I would mostly lie on the phone. So I would say, hi. Could I have this? I want two donuts, two muffins. Oh, what is it that you want? Oh, my husband would like another two of those. And what does Aaron want? Oh, my son, he would like this, this, and that. So that's what I did. I would also drive through drive-thrus, and I would lie as well. I would say, can you put these in one bag? Put this in another bag because this is for someone else. I would not be present with my family. I would be thinking about food. I would say if we were playing games on family night or watching movies, I'd say, I have to go to CVS to pick up a prescription. And they never caught on that it was 10 o'clock at night. And obviously the pharmacy was closed. I would eat behind doors in my house. I had food in my mouth. And if people were talking to me, I would spit it out. We're just trying to check my time. So, okay, I threw away invitations to events, hoping that they wouldn't, hoping that my family wouldn't remember, because I just did not want to be seen. I remember that fat was horrible and terrible and a sign of failure. So the food was hidden everywhere. It was in my pockets. If I ever sell my house, I'm telling you, they will find it in every corner because I'm sure some is still there. So I believe that life event can bring you the program. It doesn't just have to be rock bottom. It can be, and it was for me. But it's also can be life events. So fast forward to November 6, 2020. My son called me from the emergency room at Johns Hopkins. He was in college at Johns Hopkins. And he said, Mom, They found something on my brain. I can't talk right now. I got to go. They're doing tests. So we drove from Boston, and he has a brain tumor. So that was my moment of truth. That was my rock bottom and my moment of truth. I was in the height of my disease, but I knew that I couldn't be there 100% for him, because I could not have both in my head. There just was not enough room for my disease and for that. The doctors had said that the best, the patients who do the best are people who have family that advocate. So I knew that I needed to put the food aside, be present, be able to research everything there was to know about this rare brain tumor, be able to get him the best care, be able to ask the doctors the right questions and understand the answers. And I threw myself into that, which meant I needed to get a handle on my disease, and I needed spirituality. So that brings me to Park B. I had been in and out of program for a lot of years, but I had never been abstinent, and I had never, ever opened the big book or did the steps. When I was in Baltimore at Hopkins, I thought, okay, I'm going to go. I knew I had bought a big book, but I knew it was tucked away somewhere. I wasn't sure if I bought it, and I wasn't sure where it was. So I went up to my attic, which is one of those like things where you have stairs. There was stuff everywhere in the big book that I guess I had once bought was right there at the top of my stairs. Unless Casper was there, it had to have been my higher power. I have racked my brain since. I hadn't thought about it until I was in Baltimore. So there's no way I could have looked for that big book. I remember hesitating to grab it, and I wasn't sure why I was hesitating, but I now know why I was hesitating. Because my higher power, I'm going to read this because I put down the words, so I wouldn't forget them. My higher power was saying to me, I know that you need me now. Here is my Bible and my instruction manual. I have no religious affiliation, and I will be anything you want me to be. Make sure you read every page carefully, and I will take you step by step and show you a life you have never dreamed of, and you will be born again. But there's one thing you need to promise me, and that you will do. You will do extensive work with another, because the goal of this program is not to recover. It's to recover so that you can sponsor another and give back what you have so graciously been given. And if you don't believe me, try me. So I found a speaker meeting and a sponsor. But after a while, it was like, okay, I get it. You guys are recovered. You have what I want, but I need to know how to do it. So I found a sponsor, and the process was very, very, very painfully slow. We met two times a week. One time I forgot where I was, and one time she forgot where we were. And it was some kind of serenity thing, but it caused anything but serenity. It caused a lot of anxiety because it had numerous assignments. And I knew that in order for me to get abstinent, I needed the steps, period. The first three steps I did because they told me to do it. But I knew I needed to get through the steps because I needed to stop eating. So she ate, the sponsor, and then I ate. And I don't want to say like kind of that I was happy that she ate, but anyway, before she left, she gave me a gift that I can never repay. She said, you know, that guy that you listen to on those tapes that you love, that you're just, you know, you can't believe what you're hearing. His name is Harlan. And there's a meeting that he has that he goes to. And this is the information. She gave me a gift I can never repay her. I knew that if I went to his meeting, it's almost like sacrilegious to go to that meeting. And it's like, you just can't. The recovery at that meeting is phenomenal. So I went to Scottsdale. I stayed after and I just cried. I let everything out. And I found my soulmate and my sponsor that first night. She opened her mouth. I just knew that I knew her. I knew that I loved her. I told her recently if I was gay, I would ask her to marry me. I've never left her side. She's never left my side from that day. So I struggled for the first three steps because I struggled with the whole food God thing. Like, how do you connect that? A fellow told me to ask for the removal of fear, to ask to remove the fear. And so that's what I did. And that's what helped me get through the first three steps. So my first awakening, when I found my higher power, was the fourth step. Because I realized that the things I was thinking and doing were about to change. And I was never going to go back. But I stayed laser focused on that fourth step without a lot of frivolous fluff, which I can explain later. But when I put my anger, my selfishness, my fear, my dishonesty, all those liabilities aside, that empty space was where he was, or her, or whatever. That was the good in me that my higher power was there. Another awakening for me happened in step 7, where it says we humbly asked God to remove our defects. So people think, okay, we ask God to remove defects, but it's all about humility. So in the 12 and 12 on page 70, it says we need to stop and think about what humility and the practice of it really is. The attainment of greater humility is the foundation principle of each AA 12 step. For without it, without some degree of humility, no alcoholic can stay sober. Bill Wilson also wrote this book, by the way, later on, like 10 or 15 years later. During this process of learning more about humility, the most profound result of all was the change in our attitude toward God. And this was true whether we had been believers or non-believers. A great turning point in our lives came when we sought for humility as something we really wanted rather than as something we must have, and marked the time when we would commence to see the full implication of step 7. With humility as our guide to move out of ourselves toward others and toward God. The whole emphasis on step 7 is on humility. So that also was a huge awakening for me. And what I describe awakenings are is just a realization, like a massive realization that something's changed. That's what an awakening is. It's not like a lightning bolt that just like you see God. The 10 steps are also very important to me. I remember at the beginning when I was doing them, I would come into it like crazy. And then I would feel nothing afterward. And I asked my sponsor, I said, you know, I feel really detached. Like, what's going on with me? I have no feeling. And she said, you do have feeling, and it's called serenity. And it's true. If you really do it and you really believe that you have those character liabilities or defects, then you do get relief from step 10. The next major awakening was this wonderful step 12, which is extensive work with others, which means when it says extensive, it means sponsoring. The fine point on my contract with my higher power is to give back what I've generously been given, because it's not part of the program to take and not give. It's just not. So some extra points that I wanted to mention is that this program is not a solo program, which means I believe that the cameras have to be on and you have to share. You can't just go to like a big book meeting and say, okay, I'm doing the steps. It has to be a one-on-one where you actually do the steps. On step 4 and step 10, I try not to judge my character defects. I stand aside from them and I look at them as nothing more than something that's holding me back. That's it. I mean, they can be called anything, selfishness, dishonesty, whatever, but I just don't take them personal.
It's 5 minutes left, Bonnie.
Yep, I got it. I got it right here and I'm almost done. People say wait 2 days for a sponsor. I feel like you need to start right away because there's footwork. You need to think about your food. You need to ask, you know, you should interview around, ask about food, if they want a food plan, assignments, how often you're going to speak to them. Is it a slow process? Is it a long process? Will they help you sponsor? Because that's really important. I know a lot of people are really afraid to sponsor, including me. But if you get someone to help you, then there's nothing to be afraid of. And that's it. So I still have a couple of minutes. That's all I got. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.